Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, you might think a media debate about voter fraud would have the question of whether such fraud exists at its center. Instead, stories focus on the controversy around voter ID laws, or lately, whether those laws are supported by voters who don't know anything about them. Putting the facts back in the story was left to journalism students, who thankfully were up to the task. We'll hear from Corbin Carson of the Who Gets to Vote project, based at Arizona State University. Also on the show, the British newspaper The Guardian has come under fire for hiring far-right commentator Josh Trevino. Much of the criticism centers on Trevino's cheering the Israeli Defense Force's killing of passengers aboard a flotilla challenging the blockade of the Gaza Strip. He says he's being misunderstood. Critics say what they don't understand is why The Guardian would give regular column space to that perspective. Ali Abu Nima of Electronic Intifada will join us to talk about that. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
Coverage of Paul Ryan illustrates just how hard established media will push a storyline once it's in place. You'd think, with time, that reporters might come to question, at least a little, the notion of Ryan as a budget savant. Maybe by looking at the plan that Image is based on, with its trillions of dollars of tax cuts supposedly outweighed by spending cuts he won't disclose, and deduction eliminations he won't disclose. Instead, reporters are doubling down. For instance, the Ryan plan would replace Medicare's single-payer structure with a voucher scheme, with the government giving seniors money to buy private insurance. Congressional Budget Office estimates say those vouchers won't cover all costs, and that the typical senior would end up paying around $6,000 more out of pocket in the plan's first year. But an August 14th segment ABC News described as a reality check on the issue had Jonathan Carl focusing on the idea that if you bought a plan that was cheaper than the voucher amount, you could get cash back. He held up a whiteboard with "check for $1,000" written on it to underscore what could come in the mail. Elsewhere in the liberal media, Time magazine calls Ryan as deep as Palin was shallow, with, quote, an almost unsettling fluency in the fine print of massive budget documents, close quote. And finally, at least for the moment, quote, Ryan is to budget math what Carl Sagan was to the science of the cosmos, close quote. It's kind of unfair to say when Sagan isn't here to defend himself.
With so many reporters not just drinking, but mixing and selling Kool-Aid of various sorts, you might think that's the only way to do it. It isn't, of course, but journalists who go beyond eliciting and nodding at pre-registered talking points are met with, well, what would you call it? Here's what happened August 14th when Soledad O'Brien of CNN's Starting Point tried to inject some evidence into Romney surrogate John Sununu's line of the day, which was, as you may know, that Obamacare entails a $716 billion cut to Medicare benefits.
It is clear in here that the reduction in services start on January 1st, 2013. And Obama stole that money to put it into
the
programs.
The hospitals agreed
under
to that.
Obama
the drug
care.
Providers agreed to that because their theory is that what they're going to be able to do is make up by the number of people who come into the system. It doesn't reduce or cut the benefits, right? The older people who
it
receive
does.
Medicare do
they're
not.
They're assuming. Soledad, stop this. All you're doing is mimicking the stuff that comes out of the White House and gets repeated on the Democratic blog boards out there. If you're going to mouth
I'm telling you what factcheck.com tells you. I'm telling you what the CBO tells you. I'm telling you what CNN's independent analysis
does. I've got the CBO report right here.
And I'm telling you what it says.
Put an Obama bumper sticker on your forehead when you do this.
You know, let me tell you something. There is independent analysis that details what this is about. And
no,
repeating
there isn't.
A number. Oh, yes, there is. Yes, there is.
No, there's,
and repeating
there's Democratic
a number,
analysis.
Sir, let me finish.
There's Democratic analysis.
Let me finish. There's independent analysis FactCheck.com, the CBO, and CNN has also done its own independent analysis. And name-calling to me and somehow acting as if by you repeating a number of $716 billion that you can make that stick when that figure is being stolen from Medicaid, that's Medicare, that's not true. You can't just repeat it and make it true.
It's a reduction in services.
When O'Brien challenged Romney stand-in Tim Pawlenty on the issue days later, he suggested she might not know what the CBO report said in English, by which he says he meant in layman's terms. So he wasn't questioning her English proficiency, just her ability to understand big words. Both cases reveal how unprepared some politicians are to be challenged, which really ought to be news.
ABC's This Week on August 19th was devoted to the question of whether or not the United States is going bankrupt. It's not, but raising the level of panic about the U.S. being the next Greece is apparently worth a debate. Anchor Jake Tapper ran through the ticking time bombs and fiscal cliffs. Viewers were told that over the next 75 years, Medicare's deficit will be $30 trillion. Absent any meaningful context, that number might as well be $300 trillion. But since the point is scary numbers, Tapper next turned to the old favorite, Social Security. He told viewers this.
Social Security will run out of money in just 20 years. In short, if nothing is done, our national debt poses a clear and present danger to the United States.
Well, that is alarming, sure. It's also false. Social Security doesn't run out of money. Tapper is probably referring to the date at which it will exhaust its trust fund. Money that was built up in anticipation of the baby boomer retirement. After that date, absent any of the minor adjustments that are needed to shore up the system, it would continue to pay out about 75% of scheduled benefits until the year 2086. It's hard enough to have a serious debate about whether the United States will soon be Greece, but it's even harder to do that when the reporter moderator is peddling misinformation.
As we've said many times before, much of the coverage of the threat posed by Iran and the subsequent threats from the U.S. and Israel to take military action treat allegation as if it were fact. As the Washington Post put it on August 17th, Israeli threats to attack Iran, quote, are forcing an unwelcome debate in the thick of a presidential campaign about the U.S. role in stopping an Iranian bomb, close quote. You see similar language elsewhere. The United States will not allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon, or even a reference to the idea that there's still time for sanctions and negotiations to persuade Iran not to build a nuclear weapon. Well, this all makes sense only if Iran is actually building a nuclear weapon. They adamantly say they are not, and there is no evidence yet to show that they're lying. And if a story is, like this one in the Washington Post, entirely about the status of Iran's nuclear program, then that information belongs somewhere other than where it appears, the very last paragraph.
And finally, there's nothing quite like the demise of a U.S. allied dictator to get elite media talking about the clash between U.S. ideals and reality. Thus, the August 22nd headline in the New York Times, Ethiopian leader's death highlights gap between U.S. interests and ideals. Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi was, in Jeffrey Gettleman's words, notoriously repressive and much more. Quote, despite being one of the United States' closest allies on the continent, Mr. Meles repeatedly jailed dissidents and journalists, intimidated opponents and their supporters to win mind-bogglingly one-sided elections, and oversaw brutal campaigns in restive areas of the country where the Ethiopian military has raped and killed many civilians, close quote. That first word of that passage, despite, is a signal that we are supposed to see this record as incompatible with our own strong values. Gettleman admits later that Ethiopia is hardly alone in raising difficult questions on how the United States should balance interests and principles. He then cites U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and an array of one-party rulers across Africa, all of this, quote, despite a commitment to promoting democracy, close quote. Well, that's a strange level of commitment. Of course, there's a long list of tyrants, dictators, and human rights abusers the United States has supported, from Suharto in Indonesia to Mubarak in Egypt, for a time Saddam Hussein. Reagan-era policies in Latin America supported strongmen and fielded armies to overthrow governments the U.S. didn't care for. Most people with a passing knowledge of this history recognize that there are too many exceptions to this rule about American ideals to make it a rule at all. So every now and then an article like this one appears, expressing some puzzlement over the gap between what the United States practices and what it preaches. An effective propaganda system requires these small openings.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Voter ID laws, like the one recently upheld by a Pennsylvania court, have been reported as controversial, and that's true. They're being pushed overwhelmingly by Republicans and resisted overwhelmingly by Democrats, who say the negative impact of requiring photo ID will fall disproportionately on poor, elderly, and black people who are more often their constituents. But if you remove the question of partisanship, as we are so often enjoined to do, you're still left with the question of whether such laws are necessary. We're told they protect the integrity of the voting process. But from what exactly? News 21 is a national investigative reporting project funded by the Carnegie Corporation and the Knight Foundation and based at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Arizona State University. Their 2012 effort is Who Can Vote?, a multi-part, multimedia reporting project on voting rights, produced by 24 students from 11 universities across the country. Corbin Carson is a member of the News 21 team and focused particularly on allegations of voter fraud. He joins us now by phone from Phoenix. Welcome to Counterspin, Corbin Carson.
Janine, thank you for having me.
Well, the Who Can Vote project looks at a number of voting rights issues, but you led a team investigating the particular sort of voter fraud that we're told we need new laws to prevent. Tell us, if you would, about the scope of your investigation and what you ultimately found out about the prevalence of this phenomenon.
At the beginning of the year, we began a lot of investigation into how much voter fraud there actually is. And would that be stopped by the new voter ID law? So then in early May, we sent public records requests to each of the 50 departments of elections or secretaries of state across the nation. We included the District of Columbia Board of Elections, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the FBI. What we were looking for was information about any cases since 2000 involving election fraud, including the name of the accused, the charges they were accused of, and the disposition of the case. One of the first things we realized was that there is a language or a terminology differentiation, meaning many people are terming this voter fraud, meaning one voter or a voter like me or you. What we found was election crimes can be anything from absentee ballot fraud, casting an ineligible vote, voting twice, intimidation, campaign fraud, false election counts, etc. And sometimes these are committed by campaign officials, election officials, third-party organizations, and about a third of the time, voters like me or you. And out of that, we found, or what was reported to us, was 2,068 cases since 2012. Of those 2,068 cases, only 10 cases were of voter impersonation, and that is the only type of election crime that the new 37 states' voter ID laws can prevent.
To underscore, that's 10 cases since 2000 of this particular kind of a false name and the person shows up and a false vote, if you will, is cast.
Correct. So what we're talking about is with 146 million registered voters in the United States during that time, those 10 cases represent about one of out of every 15 million prospective voters.
So when people like the Republican National Lawyers Association talk about hundreds of cases of fraud, you think what might be going on is kind of mixing up voter fraud, that specific thing, with this broader category of election fraud?
Correct. And then you have to, not only mixing up, but you add in allegations, you add in any accusations that haven't been founded or convicted. Our conviction rate was really low. So the 2,068 cases, not all of those were even convicted or taken further.
Polls show that voter ID laws have a lot of support. I think they sound like common sense to people. They think, why wouldn't you just go get an ID? But of course, part of what some of News 21's reporting shows are the reasons: costs of transportation, lack of transportation, public offices that are rarely open, and costs, you know, some of the reasons that people don't go to the polls. But it seems like explaining that is really kind of the purpose of journalism. And without that, you have this abstract conversation in which it could be argued that potential harm to the integrity of the process actually outweighs the harm of disenfranchisement to actual people. Do you think that's what would maybe improve reporting on this issue, just the injection of more straightforward evidence?
Well, as I said, we're News 21 is a nonpartisan organization, so we wouldn't presume to add our opinions into the discussion. However, it seems to me, after talking with experts around the country for months on this issue, what we're hearing, the common thread is that the election system itself needs work. It's run different by each county, and there's over 3,000 counties, and we had to talk to most of them in order to conduct this. So possibly maybe more interest could be paid into fixing the election system, specifically since the voter ID laws are only preventing a case that it comes up. The database shows 207 cases of other types of fraud for every one case of voter impersonation.
It is interesting that part of what you found was concern around, for example, absentee ballots and things like that, and yet they have not become the focus of such debate.
Correct.
Well, you took a long time doing this project. You faced a lot of issues, as you've indicated, getting the information from widely varying responses from public records offices. Do you think working journalists you'll have the same kind of ability to do this work when you become a professional journalist? I mean, you had months and months of time and you had a lot of institutional support. How do you think it'll be different if you were trying to cover this story as a journalist?
That's sort of a running joke around News 21, and also one of the coolest things of News 21. One of the things that the organization focuses on is bringing back investigative journalism. Because of social media, news is old a few seconds from now, as you well know. So having the ability and the funding to spend almost an entire year on one project is unique. And we were told many times that we will not to expect that when we enter the working force of journalism.
Comment, if you will, just finally, because to give some flavor of the scope of the project, it really is multimedia. There's data that folks can interact with and find cases of voter fraud in their locality. It really is much more than a single report, isn't it?
Absolutely. Not only did we just focus on voter fraud, we talked about voter disenfranchisement. We looked at poll watchers. We looked at an array of different cases involving voting rights. But as you said, I encourage your listeners to go to the site and play with the database. I use play because it's very interactive. You can click on your state, and you can look at the cases that were sent to us. You can see the email responses from state officials that were sent to us. It's all right there for the public to view.
And finally, on the issue of voter fraud, you are updating the database day to day. If more cases of fraud come in, they'll make their way in.
We have a workflow set up between students that are updating the database so that it's up to date, continuing through the election cycle.
We've been speaking with Corbin Carson, graduate student in journalism at Arizona State University and an investigator with News 21. You can find Who Can Vote online at votingrights.news21.com. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Janine, thank you for having me.
For a lot of people, the British newspaper The Guardian has a reputation for thoughtful, independent commentary and reporting. But that reputation would seem to be threatened by their decision to hire far-right columnist Josh Trevino, whose record of inflammatory and violent writing has critics wondering what on earth the paper was thinking. We're joined now by one person who's raising these questions. Ali Abunima is the co-founder of the website Electronic Intifada. Ali, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, we've been through several cycles of this story already. The Guardian isn't sure what to call him. First, Trevino was a correspondent, then he was a commentator. We know he's very conservative. Some people have wondered whether they think of him as sort of an ideological counterweight to Glenn Greenwald, who the Guardian just hired as well. But the case against Trevino comes down to, let's be frank, and you've written about this, his incitement to murder. Tell us about that record.
Yes, it's two things. One is a very clear record of incitement to murder. And the second part is lying about it and claiming that that record does not exist in the pages of The Guardian. So there's two really important issues here. But to kind of summarize it, when The Guardian announced his hiring on August 15th, there was a lot of outrage because a lot of people remember that back in June 2011, Trevino was very vocal when unarmed peace activists, including Alice Walker, including Holocaust survivor Hedy Epstein, were attempting to sail to Gaza. Trevino tweeted, "Dear IDF, if you end up shooting any Americans on the new Gaza flotilla, well, most Americans are cool with that, including me." And many critics, including myself, viewed that as incitement to the Israeli army, the IDF, to murder unarmed civilians. I wrote about it. The Guardian responded by getting Trevino to write a so-called clarification on August 16th, which was this lengthy piece to try and explain away this tweet. And what's interesting about it is he kind of pretends that there's just this one tweet. And he says the following: "Any reading of my tweet of 25 June 2011 that holds that I applauded, encouraged, or welcomed the death of fellow human beings is wrong and out of step with my life and record." So the case he's making there is that this was just a one-off thing. And I think it's important to note that The Guardian's editors, including the editor-in-chief, Alan Rusbridger, and the Guardian's press office started distributing this so-called clarification by Trevino in order to kind of mitigate or respond to the growing protests. So the question then was, is it true that he has never applauded, encouraged, or welcomed the death of fellow human beings? Well, that's when people really started digging. Many people wrote about this online and on Twitter, and I published a series of pieces about it on the Electronic Intifada. And it turns out that, in fact, there is a mountain of evidence and statements by Trevino in which he encourages, welcomes, and applauds the killing of fellow human beings. I'm talking about dozens or hundreds of statements. So I'm only going to give you a couple here because it's too many. But for example, a year before the infamous tweet that started this all off, you'll remember on May 31st, 2010, the Mavi Marmara was sailing to Gaza. It was actually sailing away from Gaza at the time. Israeli commandos attacked it in international waters and killed 9 people on board. One of those people was an American teenager called Furkan Doğan. And here's what Trevino tweeted about Furkan Doğan at the time. He said, "There are some Americans who are better off without. Furkan Doğan is one of them." He also said, "Make no mistake, in choosing to aid Hamas on the flotilla, Furkan Doğan raised his hand against his country. His fate was deserved." Of course, the claim there is that anyone who shows solidarity with Palestinians is aiding Hamas and aiding terrorism. Another thing he said that is just horrifying, he said, "Only way the flotilla story gets better is if it's revealed the IDF drew Mohammed on a bulkhead." So he was saying that basically that, you know, he wasn't just happy that people had been killed, but he also wanted, you know, anti-Muslim religious desecration to take place. And a final one, He said, after examining the facts on Flotilla, I condemn Israel for being too nice, too soft, too accommodating to the scum of the earth. And as I said, that's just four or five examples. But we're talking about hundreds of statements that belie the claim published in The Guardian that he has never done this.
Now, one of The Guardian's responses came via their blog editor, and this is worth some examination as well. He said that Trevino represents a strand of thinking in the GOP that is in the ascendancy. Josh is well-placed to articulate that. You had some thoughts about that kind of journalistic standard.
It's really incredible because, you know, they're claiming that Trevino is somehow this expert and insider on Republican politics. And this is relevant. I mean, Trevino is a political consultant, and his main or most prominent role was as communications director for a guy called Chuck DeVore, who attempted to get the Republican nomination in California for the United States Senate in 2010. And one of the pieces I wrote on the Electronic Intifada focuses on how Trevino was feeding DeVore these Islamophobic lines. And this Islamophobic rhetoric. And that's really all very clear. The evidence is there. So The Guardian is claiming that, oh, well, you know, all that stuff doesn't matter. It's all in the past. We want him for his, you know, insights on Republican strategy. But the standard it seems to set is that if any kind of racism or bigotry is in the ascendancy, what do? You give it a platform. You allow somebody to spout this stuff from your publication. So, I mean, when everyone was saying that Al-Qaeda was in the ascendancy or jihadism was in the ascendancy in different places around the world, I don't recall The Guardian giving anyone from Al-Qaeda a branded column, a daily column. And more than that, they're actually promoting him because in the press release that announced him, his hiring, The Guardian actually has the name of a person to contact to do media bookings. So it's not just that he is, you know, some freelancer. They announced him as really a prominent, an integral part of the team, and they were going to spend resources to promote him and get his voice out into the media.
We've been speaking with Ali Abunima. He's the co-founder of the website Electronic Intifada. You can read it at electronicintifada.net. Ali, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.